My name is Michael McCusker. Today is going to be a bit of a potpourri of subjects. Two of them something I wrote. So I should probably give the disclaimer that some of what you're going to hear is my opinion, and perhaps my opinion only, in the entire universe and comparative cosmos. Well, a memorial service was held yesterday in Prescott, Arizona, for 19 members of the Granite Mountain Hotshot crew who were incinerated by a wildfire on June 30th. I spent a few seasons half a century ago on a U.S. Forest Service hotshot crew, Dalton Hotshots, in the Angeles National Forest, some of which I revisited this last trip down into California. I would like to read something I wrote for my newspaper, the North Coast Times-Eagle, in 1994, when 14 hotshots were killed on a forest fire in Colorado in July that year, which is 19 years ago, and 9 of them were from a Prineville, Oregon hotshot crew. I call it Dying Like Squirrels. Norman McLean might never have realized how his posthumously published book, Young Men and Fire, would become useful and perhaps necessary to explain the deaths in early July 1994 of more than a dozen forest firefighters, which included 9 from Prineville, Oregon. McLean is more recognized by his very popular book that Robert Redford made into a movie, A River Runs Through It. He was, however, obsessed with the 1949 Montana forest fire that killed 11 smoke jumpers. He spent years researching and tramping over the killing ground of the August 10 Mann Gulch fire of 63 years ago, and exhaustively interviewed to enduring friendships the survivors who escaped the terrible deaths of their comrades. McLean wrote in Young Men in Fire, "Burning to death on a mountainside is dying at least 3 times. First, considerably ahead of the fire, you reach the verge of death in your boots and your legs. Next, as you fall, you sink back in the region of strange gases and blue darts where there is no oxygen, and here you die in your lungs. Then you sink in prayer into the main fire that consumes you, and if you are Catholic, about all that remains of you is your cross." The men and women who were incinerated in July 1994 while fighting a forest fire in Colorado were members of hotshot crews. Being a hotshot in the U.S. Forest Service is equivalent to the hard-ass, perpetually hardship infantry. And though the media claims hotshots are elite firefighting crews, they are probably still treated like the infantry. If any possessed intelligence, none would be either, is the traditional attitude. In the past at least, hotshots were the dogs of the Forest Service, hardly more classy than prison crews sent out to fight the same fires. Hotshots battle their enemy with hand weapons just as dog-faced soldiers, axes, brush hooks, Pulaskis, McLeods, and shovels with which they chop, hack, and scrape trails through the burning wilderness. Wildfire is their enemy, inhuman in contrast to soldiers' nemesis. Sinewy, monstrous, incredibly dangerous and threatening, hot as the sun, grasping for fuel and oxygen to remain alive, sucking human lungs dry at the same instant its intense heat evaporates blood and tissue. Which is what happened to 14 hotshots on a fire in Glenwood Springs, Colorado, working a hotline on a 2-bit tree fire that suddenly exploded into a wind-whipped inferno and trapped 50 firefighters. Most escaped, though barely. 9 of the 14 dead were from the hotshot crew based in Prineville, 5 men and 4 women. John Kelso, Bonnie Holby, and Terry Hagen from Prineville, Rob Johnson and Doug Dunbar from Redmond, Levi Brinkley from Burns, Kathy Beck from Eugene, Tammy Bickett from Powell Butte, and Scott Blecka from Clatskanie. If it is any consolation, they probably died instantly, consumed as quickly as if a bomb had fallen on them. When each flared like a match, they were already dead from the fire's lung-sucking heat bellows, dehydrated crisper than potato chips. 10 years, I beg your pardon, and 5 days after the cremations of the smoke jumpers in Montana in 1949, 15 members of a luckless Southern California hotshot crew blundered into a box canyon while seeking a tactical advantage over a wildfire. The fire caught them there, and every one of the hotshots died, though the number of dead is disputed. The 11 who died in 1949 are said to be the most deaths of a forest fire crew on a single fire until July 1994. Yet witnesses on other hotshot crews who futilely attempted to rescue the dead hotshots that summer of 1959, which was my first fire season, and instead searched for their charred remains, are certain 15 died. Years later, men who failed to save the doomed hotshots claim to have heard screams from their inflamed peers. Unless a subliminal empathy of terror connected the dying with their helplessly thwarted rescuers, it was impossible to hear any noise but the roar of the fire, which could be compared with hurricane surf heard from inside a sea cave. Puny human squeals of terror would be unheard. Past and recent deaths of smoke jumpers and hotshots underscore the grim reality that fighting forest fires is incredibly dangerous and is rated the most deadly occupation of government employ, with the exception of wartime combat service, the infantry mostly. The smoke jumpers at Man Gulf died like squirrels, McLean wrote. So did the 15 hotshots in 1959 and the Prineville hotshots in 1994 and everyone else fried out of life on a wildfire. It should not end there, he said, smoke drifting away and leaving terror without consolation of explanation and controversy without lasting settlement. Probably most catastrophes end this way without an ending, the dead not even knowing how they died, but still alertly erect in fear and wonder, and that's a quote within a quote, those who love them forever questioning this unnecessary death, again a quote within a quote, and the rest of us tiring of this inconsolable catastrophe and turning to the next one. And that was McLean. And, of course, the latest one has been the 19 firefighters in Arizona. And some say that's the worst number in 80 years. But as in Vietnam, it's probably reasonable not to trust body counts. And my comparison with hotshots with combat infantry is quite personal, having done both. Now I'd like to read something I wrote, so the disclaimer still holds. I call it Bloody Thursday, and I'll just start reading. The 150th anniversary of the Civil War battles of Gettysburg and Vicksburg, both won by the Union on the same day, are celebrated this July 4th. Perhaps we should also take account of an anniversary the following day that commemorates a bloody battle which occurred during the lopsided and never-ending labor wars in this country. July 5th is the 79th anniversary of Bloody Thursday, the most violent day of the Great Pacific Coast Maritime Strike of 1934. 79 years ago this summer, San Francisco was paralyzed by the largest general strike staged by labor unions in this country. It started as a maritime strike in the spring of 1934 when thousands of longshoremen, stevedores as they were often called, walked off the job because they were sick of bad pay and humiliating treatment. They were joined by seamen, teamsters, and other maritime unions, and through unanimous action, closed the port of San Francisco for more than 2 months. No ship was loaded or unloaded. No cargo was moved off the docks. In sympathy with the strikers, longshoremen went out on strike in Seattle, Tacoma, Bellingham, Aberdeen, Grays Harbor, Portland, our own Astoria, Stockton, Los Angeles, San Diego, and all other Pacific Coast ports. The strike was a bloody one. Pickets and police fought bitter pitch battles with guns, gas, and clubs arrayed against rocks, bricks, and fists. The Industrial Association, a group of ship owners, presidents of stevedoring companies, and other maritime executives, made itself San Francisco's legal authority and continually attempted to open the port with scabs and police, and through hysterical newspaper and radio accounts that labeled the strikers as communists and aliens, which many were. But no matter where they came from or what they believed in, the strikers sought justice and resisted all attempts to outmaneuver them or force them back to work with nothing settled. The battles grew in ferocity until at the beginning of July they were as savage as a war. On July 3rd, the 70th anniversary of Pickett's charge at Gettysburg, thousands of strikers and police fought all day. The July 4th holiday provided a truce and the day passed peaceably. But in the early morning of Thursday, July 5th, the fighting resumed where it had left off when police and scabs attempted once more to open the port. Two strikers were shot to death by police revolvers, and several hundred suffered pistol wounds. Hundreds more were hospitalized or dragged into hiding after they were injured by gas and clubs. Mike Quinn, who was a participant of the 1934 maritime strike and a close associate of the strike leader, an Australian stevedore named Harry Bridges, wrote an account of Bloody Thursday in his book, The Big Strike. At 8 a.m. promptly, the police went into action, Quinn wrote. Tear gas bombs were hurled into the picket lines and the police charged with their clubs. Gasping and choking, the strikers were driven back to the alleys off the Embarcadero or retreated up Rincon Hill. Shots rang out as police opened fire with revolvers. Flying bricks and bullets crashed windows. Tear gas sent workers in nearby factory and office buildings swarming into the streets. The whole area was swept by a surf of fighting men. Quinn quoted a newspaper, quote, "The hottest battle took place in the front of the ILA, International Longshoremen's Association, now the ILWU, International Longshoremen's and Warehousemen's Union, on Stewart Street, where scores were gassed, clubbed, and shot. Police cars literally filled the headquarters with gas from long-range guns, and persons entrenched there poured from the doors." He wrote that workers on the San Francisco-Oakland Bay Bridge, then under construction, were forced to abandon the job for the day because of stray bullets whistling around their heads. Police charged into the Seaboard Hotel, Quinn continued, where many strikers were quartered and drove all occupants into the streets, swinging their long riot sticks and cracking skulls right and left. The building was filled with gas and riddled with pistol fire. Stubbornly holding their ground and fighting every inch of the way, and this is still Quinn, the strikers were driven back into the city and off the Embarcadero. The battle swept over into the busy downtown district, endangering crowds of pedestrians. One picket, striker, entrenched himself in a parking lot, devised a crude slingshot from an old inner tube, and began bombarding Chief of Police William J. Quinn's, no relation to Quinn, spells his with only one N, car with bricks. It took a barrage of tear gas and pistol fire to dislodge him. A badly wounded man lying on the pavement cursed the police and refused to allow them to remove him. Later he was taken to a hospital in a private car. Scores of men littered the sidewalks, either lying silently or crawling away painfully on their hands and knees. A woman alighting from a streetcar at the ferry building screamed and collapsed when a bullet struck her in the temple. A man rushed to her assistance, was struck by another bullet, and crumpled to the street beside her. A Chronicle reporter described, "Women who had been shopping in downtown stores arrived at the loop to step into an inferno. With screaming children clinging to them, they disembarked from the cars to find themselves in clouds of smarting tear gas. Guns cracked. Men fell screaming as they went down. Police clubs cracked against skulls. Smothered and blinded by gas, the women and children staggered about helplessly. Policemen grabbed them as fast as possible and sent them to a hospital where they were horrified by the sight of men dripping with blood, moaning from bullet wounds and injuries. People in surrounding buildings were driven out by gas, and many were winged by stray shots as they fled. At the height of the battle, a delegation from the strike committee, headed by Harry Bridges, called on Mayor Angelo J. Rossi to protest. The mayor simply repeated what acting California Governor Frank Merriman had said earlier, "You refuse to arbitrate, now take the consequences." Hospitals were put on a wartime basis to accommodate the wounded. At the morgue, covered over by white sheets, were two cold, quiet bodies, Howard Sperry and Nicholas Bordeaux. The striking unions had men detailed to the hospitals to see that wounded pickets received adequate attention when brought in from the battlefield. These men reported later that injured strikers were threatened and intimidated by police when they stated that their club and gunshot wounds were caused by officers. At the close of the day, Acting Governor Merriman ordered the National Guard onto the waterfront. 2,000 troops marched into the area equipped with rapid-fire guns, machine guns, gas equipment, and bayoneted rifles. By the time they arrived, the fighting had ceased and the pickets had been driven from the embarcadero. The guardsmen posted themselves at intervals down the whole length of the waterfront and mounted machine guns on the roofs of piers. Troops marched in wearing steel helmets and full service equipment. They set up camp inside the long, covered docks, established field kitchens, and remained there under wartime conditions. Divisions were brought in from Santa Rosa, Napa, Petaluma, Gilroy, and other outlying towns. Rumors were abundant to the effect that certain units had refused service, but strict censorship was maintained and definite confirmations were lacking. All day long, newspapers uptown had been pouring out extra after extra, delivering veritable hourly reports from the line of battle. Wailing sirens careening up and down Market Street aroused speculation and alarm among the public. The word blood, blood, blood recurred every three or four lines in every news story. So much blood had been seen that it obsessed the minds of news writers, and the word was repeated again and again, almost involuntarily, as they typed their copy. Reporters had been in the thick of fighting all day long. Many had bruised limbs and minor injuries to help them remember. These hurts soon healed and passed away, but an experience, a reality, was impressed in their minds that would never wear away and would affect their ideas, their decisions, and their loyalties for the rest of their lives. The strikers named the day Bloody Thursday. And that was Quinn, all those paragraphs. On Monday, July 9th, 1934, a funeral march was held for Howard Sperry and Nicholas Bordeaux. 40,000 men, women, and children marched in silence, 8 and 10 abreast the length of Market Street, behind trucks that carried the two coffins and flowers. A union band played a funeral march by Beethoven. A newspaper described the procession as a river of men flowing up Market Street like cooling lava, solemn strains of dirges and hymns, uncountable thousands of spectators lining the streets with uncovered heads, overhead a brilliant sun in a cloudless sky. Another newspaper said that the two dead strikers, quote, in life, wouldn't have commanded a second glance on the streets of San Francisco, but in death they were borne the length of Market Street in a stupendous and reverent procession that astounded the city. A week later, a general strike was declared in San Francisco, and the city was effectively shut down for 3 days. For all practical purposes, Mike Quinn wrote, not a wheel moved or a lever budged. The official reaction was hysteria. The general strike was confused with revolution. Rumors in newspapers claimed that a communist army was marching on the city from the north. Northwesterners were thought to be communists and radicals because of strong IWW activity the preceding decade. 500 extra policemen were hired and thousands more National Guardsmen were sent to San Francisco from all over California. Police red squads raided strikers' homes and union offices. Vigilantes attacked and beat striking workers that they accused of being communists. The maritime strike ended in late July 1934 and the port of San Francisco was reopened. The maritime unions were awarded recognition. Contracts were signed and demands were met or promised to be met through arbitration, among them the crucial issue of hiring halls to be controlled by the unions and a ban on blacklisting strikers from employment. Longshore pay was raised and dockside hours shortened. But all this did not bring peace to the waterfront, Mike Quinn wrote several years later. Instead, there ensued a period of industrial guerrilla warfare, which persisted for more than 2 years, ultimately resulting in the whole Pacific Coast maritime strike breaking out again in greater force than ever. And that was in 1936. The Great Maritime Strike in 1934 was the harbinger of future labor battles in steel, auto, rubber, and other smokestack industries in the United States. It heralded the vast organizing drives that gave birth to the CIO, and it set an example of militant solidarity that proved beneficial to other unions in the great labor struggles of the 1930s. The 1934 strike is memorable because, above all, it demonstrated the power latent in the rank and file, Harry Bridges said a few years later. The rank and file not only manned the picket lines and did the sacrificing, as it must in every strike, but it also made the big decisions and determined the strategy. The rank and file wouldn't be bulldozed or buffaloed, browbeaten or divided, and therefore it couldn't be licked. Once it knew the score, the rank and file could not be misled by any phony labor leader or panicked by any barrage of newspaper propaganda. Bridges said that, ultimately, the power of any union that serves as an instrumentality of the workers rests on the courage and conviction in its ranks. That is one fundamental truth that has not altered since 1934, nor will it alter in times to come. We've had strikes on the waterfront since 1934, Bridges said, but never again have the bosses dared to shoot our men down in cold blood. For many years after Bloody Thursday, each July 5th was commemorated by maritime workers who took unauthorized days off to march once again by the thousands up Market Street in honor of the two dead strikers. One ship owner bitterly complained that, on every July 5th, there is a complete cessation of work up and down the whole Pacific coast because of a holiday declared by the unions for the purpose of commemorating a day of violence and bloodshed. No one authors the July 5th holiday excepting a 100% accord of the entire maritime profession, Mike Quinn wrote in The Big Strike, which was first published in 1949, 13 years after he wrote it, and 2 years after his death at 41. Therefore, Quinn continued, it is regarded as a completely unauthorized stoppage of work and an illegal act. The maritime unions have nothing by which to defend this annual disregard for authority, other than an old, almost forgotten phrase in the yellow documents of the Revolution of 1776, which reads, by the consent of the governed. And that was something I wrote, and also liberally quoted, Mike Quinn, K-U-I-N, in his great book, The Big Strike. And it was Bloody Thursday. Now I'd like to take a little different tack and read an article that my brother, who is an avid bicyclist, gave me out of Adventure Cyclist, which is published in Missoula, Montana, and this was its June 2013 issue. The Machine That Set Women Free by David Lamb. The bicycle seems an unlikely symbol of women's liberation, but in 1894, when Annie Londonberry, carrying only a pearl-handled revolver and a change of underwear and leaving behind her husband Max and three small children, set off from Boston to cycle alone around the world. It was precisely that, as bold a statement of feminist independence as burning a bra would be in the 1960s. The young American, whose real name was Annie Cohen, Kopchowski, rode a 42-pound Columbia bicycle and wore the cumbersome multi-layered skirts, bow tie, and tailored jacket of the Victorian era. At stake was $10,000, the prize two sugar merchants had offered if she left home penniless, circled the globe as Thomas Stevens had a decade before, and returned with $5,000 of earned money. She was not allowed to accept gratuities, while trying to accomplish what no woman had ever done. Londonderry sold her autograph, photographs, and candy to make money. She picked up a $3,500 endorsement from a tire company, making her, at age 23, probably the most female athlete to get corporate sponsorship. Her name soon became a household word, and large crowds greeted her as she pedaled across Europe and Asia, two small American flags attached to her handlebars. Miss Londonderry is in the process of proving to the whole world that women are able to summon up courage and energy that very few men would be able to match, wrote the Saigon Courier as she left Vietnam. If Londonderry is to be believed, she was attacked by highwaymen in France, fell through the ice of a frozen river in Russia, was shot in the shoulder on the front lines of the Sino-Japanese War, and thrown into a Japanese prison on her two-month adventure that included hopping on trains and boats. She returned to the U.S. in February 1895, having exchanged the billowing skirts and petticoats of the Victorian woman for the tight-fitting pants favored by male cyclists. She collected her winnings and became a national hero, a trailblazer in the battle of the sexes, just as Billie Jean King would in her tennis victory over Bobby Riggs in 1973. America was caught up in a bicycling craze in the 1880s and 1890s. Excursion trains carried thousands of cyclists into the countryside from New York City for weekend rides. Male cycling clubs with uniformed riders proliferated in eastern cities. "Everyone who wants to be anybody has learned to ride," observed one newspaper. One-third of patent applications submitted to the U.S. Patent Office were related to bicycles. In 1897, more than 3,000 firms, including the Wright Cycle Company in Dayton, Ohio, owned by Orville and Wilbur Wright, were in the bicycle business. Cycling was so popular that attendance in theaters and churches dropped. But there was a catch in the early days of the cycling boom. Like society itself, cycling was dominated by men. Women who dared to ride a bicycle were often subjected to ridicule and abuse by pedestrians and horsemen, or hampered by municipal laws forbidding their participation in what was arguably the country's most popular sport. It took them 30 years to convince a puritanical nation that women and bicycles were not an immoral mix. By the time Annie Londonderry circled the globe, the bicycle had already been instrumental in changing the way women dressed. Skirts had become shorter, and the tight-fitting medieval corsets that created hourglass figures and gripped the waist with iron fingers had given way to bloomers, short, full pants fastened at the knee, and similar to the knickerbockers worn by men. To see any part of a woman's leg in public in those days, an era when women cyclists sewed weights into their hems so their skirts wouldn't blow up, was an eye-popping experience. Many were aghast. "The skirt is lifting with every wind, more or less attracting curious eyes," warned the League of American Wheelmen. In Chicago, the police department threatened to treat women in bloomers as prostitutes. The mayor of Chattanooga proposed an ordinance to keep women in bloomers off the streets because they were a menace to the peace and good morals of the male residents of this city, quote unquote. Many Americans believe no woman of refinement should even consider riding a bicycle, much less pedaling off unescorted to be tempted by a dalliance on some country road. Some non-reformists said bicycles would destroy feminine symmetry and poise, as a quote, affecting female muscles and thus making childbirth more difficult. Others worried that women would be sexually stimulated by straddling a bicycle saddle. In Flushing, Long Island, three female teachers were ordered by the school board not to ride their bikes to school. When the board met to consider the women's objections, board member A.W. Reimer offered an explanation. "It is not the proper thing for ladies to ride the bicycle. They wear skirts, of course, but if we don't stop them now, they will want to be in style with New York women and wear bloomers. Then how would our schoolrooms look with lady teachers parading among the girls and boys wearing bloomers? They might as well wear men's trousers. I suppose we'll come to that, but we are determined to stop our teachers in time before they go that far." Still, women persevered in their moment for equality. At the voting booth, in divorce courts, and on the bike paths, grew stronger. Women started forming their own cycling clubs. Albert Pope, one of America's leading bicycle manufacturers, began using bloomer-clad women in his advertisements. In Chicago, a female cyclist cold-cocked a man who taunted her at an anti-bloomer protest. The Victorian lady was becoming part of history. A new woman, self-confident, freed from domesticity and isolation, was born, and she was riding a bicycle. "Let me tell you what I think of bicycling," said Susan B. Anthony, a prominent leader of the women's suffrage movement. "I think it has done more to emancipate women than anything else in the world. It gives women a feeling of freedom and self-reliance. I stand and rejoice every time I see a woman ride by on a wheel, the picture of free, untrammeled womanhood."
You've been listening to A Story Told
I'm Michael McCusker.